Good morning. I don't know who has been messing with the temperature outside, but you left it set to March. Need to get that fixed. Welcome to Xenos East. Glad to see everybody here. We're going to be continuing our series in Hebrews today, so I encourage you to turn your Bibles there. That way you can follow along and make sure that I'm not spouting blasphemy or putting up false quotes or something. Plus, you can take notes in there, which is also a bonus. While you're turning there, I'm going to go ahead and pray for a moment. Lord, thank you for today. Thank you for bringing everybody out here. It's a great privilege that we have to be able to gather and study your word in public, and we're going to take advantage of that today. I pray that you teach us through your word. This book of Hebrews is a little complex, and it's also very enlightening, so I pray that you can teach us through what you have to say today in Hebrews 5 and 7. Amen. All right, so if you've been here for the last few weeks, you probably know this already, and if not, you're going to hear it anyway. Hebrews is less of a letter and really more of an essay. It was written, we don't know by who exactly. A lot of people think it was Paul. Other people think it might have been Priscilla or maybe Barnabas, somebody who was definitely influenced by Paul. But what the premise of Hebrews is, it was written to Jewish believers who now had really a foggy idea of how they continue in their faith. For their entire lives, for their entire nation, the existence of their people, they've been following God a certain way. And now, and all of that was pointing towards the coming Messiah. And now that the Messiah has come, and he did the job that he came to do, and we talked about that a lot last week, how Christ's work was completed and finished on the cross so that we can rest. Well, now that that's happened, they're thinking to themselves, well, now what? Do we go back to the temple? Do we go put ourselves in subjection to the priests? Do we continue with our rituals and our traditions? What's going on now? What do we do? And so the problem was a lot of them were going back and doing those things. And the author here of Hebrews is trying to convince them, no, things are different now. All that stuff you did before was foreshadowing the coming Messiah, Jesus Christ. Now that he's come here and done that, everything's changed. Everything's different. And so he goes into how comparing Christ to the angels and then to Moses, and he talked a few times up until this point about Jesus being a new high priest, which was something that they could all understand. High priest was a position of authority that they got, that they understood. It's something that's been around for a long time, and the argument here is that Jesus is the new high priest. We don't need another one. And so that's what we're going to talk about today. He's really going to lay out that whole idea of Jesus the high priest. Last week, the last verses we looked at said this. This is the end of Hebrews 4. It says, we do not have a high priest who cannot sympathize with our weaknesses, but one who is tempted in all things as we are, yet he's without sin. Therefore, let us draw near with confidence to the throne of grace so that we may receive mercy and find grace to help in time of need. And so his point here is we've got a new high priest, and he's Christ. And though he was a man just like you and me, he was tempted just like you and me. He's without sin, and he's not going to die. And so because of what he has done on the cross, you and I can draw near to God. We can get close to God, and there's nothing in between us. There's nothing to keep us from approaching God. And so that's the point. That's why we need the new high priest. So let's take a look at his argument about why Jesus is the new high priest. He says, for every high priest, this is Hebrews 5:1, every high priest taken from among men is appointed on behalf of men in things pertaining to God in order to offer both gifts and sacrifices for sins. He can deal gently with the ignorant and misguided since he himself also is beset with weaknesses. Or with weakness, and because of it, he is obligated to offer sacrifices for sins, as for the people and also for himself. And no one takes the honor to himself, but receives it when he is called by God, even as Aaron was. All right, so let's take a look at it. He's talking about priests, and I don't think we have a really solid understanding of what priests were, especially priests of his time and the Jewish priests in his day. So let's take a look at it. He's saying, first of all, their priests were taken from among men. Makes sense. It's not a gender thing. It's more of along the lines of it can't be something that's not a human. In other words, God's not going to be our priest, because the idea of a priest, the role of the priest, is to be the intermediary between us and God. We have an issue with God, and he has an issue with us, that we're sinful and he's not. He's morally perfect and we're certainly not. And so the part of the role of the priest was to be an intermediary. We can't just come to God with our sacrifices to pay for sin. We had to bring him to the priest, and the priest would then offer those sacrifices to God. That was his role. So he has to be a human being. Seems odd to point that out, but that's what's there. Seems obvious, though. He's appointed on behalf of men. So you can't just say, well, like a Christmas elf, I'm going to grow up and I want to be a dentist. That's not what happens. They had to be a specific type of, they had to come from a specific tribe, the tribe of Levi. And he mentions later Aaron was chosen by God. Aaron was the first Levitical priest from the tribe of Levi. So if you weren't from that tribe of Israel, you couldn't be a priest. And so this is going to be a big problem, because Christ was not from that tribe, but yet he's calling him as his high priest. So they're appointed. And they're appointed on behalf of things pertaining to God. So this is that whole idea of being an intermediary. There's this problem we have with God. We can't just approach him directly. We have to have an intermediary. And one of the things he does is he offers sacrifices for sins. The Old Testament was all about this. God laid out rules. This is what most people think about religion when they think about it, is all the rules. And when you break those rules, it's called sin. And so what they had to do in the Old Testament was they had to offer sacrifices to pay for sin. Specifically, when we're talking about a high priest, once a year they would have the Day of Atonement, and the high priest would offer a sacrifice for the whole nation of Israel and all their sins. This was not something that actually paid for sins, and most of them understood that, or at least they were supposed to have understood that. The idea that sin, that God takes sin very seriously, and that we're all guilty, and that a death has to occur to pay for sin. The penalty for sin is death. And so he would allow them to sacrifice animals, knowing that that didn't actually pay for their sin. These animals are not moral creatures. So what that is pointing forward to a sacrifice that he's going to provide that will ultimately pay for sin. And we know that now that that's Christ. So that one of the things that the priest was supposed to do was offer sacrifices for sin. He did that for the people, but he also had to do it for himself. And in order to do these rituals, they had to ritually cleanse themselves. Because what happens, they understood that they're sinful too. The priests, even though they wore the fancy robes, and even though they did all the fancy rituals, they were ultimately human beings, and they all sin, just like everybody does. And so, in order for them to be that intermediary, they had to offer sacrifices for their own sin first before they could offer sacrifices for everybody else's. And so, and he also says that the understanding that priests are sinful, he says he can deal gently with the ignorant and the misguided, since he himself also is beset with weakness. So the priests that they had were imperfect. That shouldn't be a surprise. And then, as I stated earlier, they were appointed from the tribe of Levi. And this is a real sticking point, because Jesus, he's calling Jesus our new high priest, and he's saying that he's the high priest, but everybody knows he's not from the tribe of Levi. Levi was the tribe that was assigned to all the priests were supposed to come from there. Jesus was from the tribe of Judah, which is fine if you're going to be king. The kings came from the tribe of Judah. And so he can't be priest. And that was probably the biggest sticking point. Why are you? And Jesus never claimed to be a priest. He never said he was a priest. He was a rabbi, which is a teacher. He called himself that, but he didn't call himself a priest. And yet here we have the author of Hebrews saying that Jesus is our new high priest. So he's going to have to make a pretty solid argument to these readers that Jesus is the new high priest, and he's going to have to do it arguing from the Old Testament. And as we've seen already through Hebrews, Hebrews is a little bit of a Bible study. He's studying the Old Testament to make his points, to prove that not only that Jesus is who he says he is and how we should behave around him or because of him, but also it kind of links together the Old Testament and the New Testament. And so we're going to see that today. He's going to make that argument that Jesus is the high priest, and it doesn't matter that he's not a Levi or a Levite. So let's read on. He says, "So also Christ did not glorify himself so as to become a high priest, but he who said to him, 'You are my son, today I've begotten you.' Just as he says also in another passage, 'You are a priest forever according to the order of Melchizedek.'" So he's going back to the Old Testament. He's saying Jesus meets these requirements. He was a man, as we saw a few weeks ago when we studied that. He says he's also, he didn't glorify himself, God glorified him when he said, "You are my son, today I have begotten you." So they all understood that Jesus was Messiah and that he was glorified by God. These are Jewish believers. But he also is pointing out, this is from Psalm 110, from the Old Testament, a psalm that they all understood to be a psalm about the Messiah. And he says, "You are a priest forever." So here we have an example in the Old Testament from a psalm that everybody understands to be messianic in nature, which is about the Messiah, that Jesus is a priest. But he's a priest not in the order of Levi. He's a priest in the order of Melchizedek. And so he's pointing out that there's a different order of priests, and that's where Jesus' priesthood comes in. So we need to understand this because it's important, to, especially to those believers in that day. It's really important to understand why Jesus is the priest, and it also is important to us and how we interact with him. So I want to take a look really quick at that psalm, just the beginning of Psalm 110, because this is what he's quoting from. He says, this is Psalm 110, he says, "The Lord says to my Lord, 'Sit at my right hand until I make your enemies a footstool for your feet. The Lord will stretch forth your strong scepter from Zion, saying, Rule in the midst of your enemies. Your people will volunteer freely in the day of your power. In holy array from the womb of the dawn, your youth are to you as the dew. The Lord has sworn and will not change his mind.'" Then we see the passage that he's quoting, "You are a priest forever according to the order of Melchizedek." So this is a psalm, and as I said, this is a messianic psalm. They understood that, and it's because of this passage right here. "The Lord says to my Lord." This is written by King David. King David didn't have a Lord. The Lord, the first Lord, is translated from the word Yahweh. That's God's name. And he's saying, God is saying to my Lord, Adonai, which is the word that's being used there. That word is used either by a human lord who has authority over you, or they used it also to refer to God. Well, David was king. He didn't have any rulers over him. He wouldn't recognize any that were over him. So it doesn't make sense for him to say that this is a human being. This, he's talking about the Messiah here. They all understood this. They knew that this was messianic in nature. In fact, if you remember our study in Matthew that we did before we got into Hebrews, Jesus brought this up when he was talking to the Pharisees, and he was questioning them about the role of the Messiah. And he says, "Well, what do you think about the Christ? Whose son is he?" And he's saying descendant. And they say, "Well, he's the son of David." And Jesus said to them, "Well, then how does David in the Spirit call him Lord when he said, 'The Lord said to my Lord, sit at my right hand until I put your enemies beneath your feet'? If David calls him Lord, how can he then be his son?" You see what he's saying here? This is the argument. David shouldn't be calling anybody my Lord except for God, and he's calling the Messiah God. Jesus' argument here is, see, I'm God. I'm the Messiah. So they knew that the psalm was about the Messiah. And we know that the psalm is about the Messiah being king because he brings up the idea of the scepter and the rulership of the Messiah. Scepter is like a rod that a king would carry as a symbol of his rulership. But this psalm not only calls the Messiah king, which is what everybody knew, but it also calls the Messiah a priest according to the order of Melchizedek. So here is the author of Hebrews arguing that, yes, indeed, we can have a high priest who's not a Levite. He's not from the tribe of Levi. In fact, we knew this was going to happen from David when he wrote it in Psalm 110 that the Messiah was going to be a priest as well. He's going to be a priest king. Okay. So who's this Melchizedek guy? That's the big question, right? If there was a line of priests that's greater than the line of Levi's, then we should know about him. Melchizedek must have been a pretty big, important guy that everybody knew about. In fact, if you looked in the beginning of your Bible and you looked in the table of contents, you're not going to find, though, a book of Melchizedek, unfortunately. In fact, right now we're going to read the entire history of Melchizedek that's given in the Old Testament, and it's these three verses in Genesis 14. This is it. This is where we get who Melchizedek is. So let's think about that. I'm going to give you a little lead into what this passage talks about. Abraham was the father of all the Jewish people. He was the first Jew. And what was going on was he was kind of a nomad. He was wandering around Canaan, which was eventually going to become Israel, many years from then, centuries. And him and his nephew were getting kind of rich. They had a lot of flocks, and the land couldn't support them both, so they separated. And his nephew Lot went to live near this town called Sodom. Now, these bandit kings came through Sodom, and they kind of did their thing there, and they took away all the people, and they took away all their food and all of their animals and all the loot, essentially, from the town, including Abraham's nephew. Abraham decides, all right, I got to go take care of this. So he gets his people together. They go. They take care of the kings, the bandit kings that took out his folks. He rescues everybody. He comes out of there with all his loot and all the people. And he come back, and on their way back through Canaan, and what was in the area that's going to be Israel, he comes across this guy named Melchizedek. Melchizedek, we can read right here, Genesis 14:18, says, Melchizedek, the king of Salem, brought out bread and wine, which I think is interesting. Here we've got a guy being compared to Jesus, and the first thing we read about him is that he brings bread and wine. That becomes important for Jesus. Anyway, he says, now he was a priest of God Most High. He blessed him, and what that means is Melchizedek blessed Abraham and said, blessed be Abram, which is before Abraham's name was changed to Abraham. Blessed be Abram, the God of the God Most High, possessor of heaven and earth, and blessed be God Most High, who has delivered your enemies into your hand. And then he, Abraham, gave him, Melchizedek, a tenth of all. That's it. That's Melchizedek's story. This was in about 2000 BC. So 2000 years before Jesus, about 1000 years before Psalm 110 was written by David. This is way back. And that's it. One of the things I want to point out about this passage, though, is that he says Melchizedek was a priest of God Most High. Now, what do we know about priests? They had to be from the tribe of Levi, right? Well, there is no tribe of Levi. There's only one Jew. It's Abraham. And maybe, I guess, his wife, too. So there's two. There is no tribe of Levi. In fact, this is it. This is proof that God, yes, worked through the Jewish nation, but he was also working through non-Jewish people as well. Melchizedek's not even Jewish. And yet, he doesn't say he thought he was a priest. He doesn't say he was a priest of somebody or of some god or some pagan god or whatever. It says he was actually a priest of God Most High, and Abraham accepted him as such, as we'll see. So now we have an example of a priest who's not from Levi. Let's read on back in our passage in Hebrews to see what the author is going to do with this. He says, this Melchizedek, king of Salem, priest of the Most High God, who met Abraham as he was returning from the slaughter of the kings and blessed him, to whom also Abraham apportioned a tenth of all the spoils, was, first of all, by the translation of his name, king of righteousness, then also king of Salem, which is king of peace. Without father, without mother, without genealogy, having neither beginning of days nor end of life, but made like the Son of God, he remains a priest perpetually. Okay, so he's making the point here that Melchizedek is greater than all the Levitical priests. So let's see if we can follow his logic. First of all, he says that Melchizedek blessed Abraham. That's important. Blessing was something that was done in the Old Testament, but it was always done from a superior to an inferior. Like a father would bless his sons, or a priest would bless a king, because spiritually the priest was higher than the king. Now, Abraham had a pretty good relationship with God. God had already spoken to Abraham directly several times before this point. Abraham didn't say to him, "Hey, when will I bless you? This seems inappropriate. Let me bless you. I'm the one who's really God's mouthpiece here." That's not what he's saying. In fact, he said, okay, and he got on his knees and he accepted the blessing. So he accepted that Melchizedek was a priest, and he was his own. He was Abraham's intermediary between him and God. He outranked him spiritually. He also went on, and Abraham apportioned a tenth of a part of the spoils. Do you know what it's called when you give a tenth of something to a priest? A tithe, right? Do you know when the tithe came into place? When the law came in and where God said you have to give tithes? That was done in about 600 years after this. He gave that law to Moses. So that law didn't exist. And yet here we see Abraham bending his knee to this guy and honoring him as a priest and giving him a tenth of all the spoils. He's giving him a tithe. Clearly, Abraham is giving this guy the honor that he deserves as a priest. Now, it's important to note that Abraham was pretty high up there in the hierarchy of Jewish heroes. In fact, the only time that you would see somebody, every time you see somebody honoring somebody else, it's always they're honoring their ancestors. The elder is always the more important, right? So what he's saying here is, Levi and Aaron, the first high priest, they were descendants of Abraham, and they're less than Abraham. Abraham was the top dog, and here it is, Abraham deferring to Melchizedek. Therefore, all the priests and all the Jews who came after Abraham also are inferior to Melchizedek, spiritually. So, if a Levitical priest comes along and meets Melchizedek, he would have to defer to Melchizedek because Melchizedek has higher authority. And he goes on and he says this later on in Hebrews 7. He says, the one whose genealogy is not traced from them collected a tenth. So he's saying the one who's not a Jew, he collected a tenth from Abraham and blessed the one who had the promises. Abraham had all these promises from God. But without any dispute, the lesser is blessed by the greater. He's saying, look, nobody questions this. The one who is lesser is always blessed by the one who is greater. Abraham was blessed by Melchizedek. Therefore, Melchizedek was greater than Abraham. Okay. Well, then he goes on and he talks about this guy Melchizedek. His actual name means King of Righteousness. That's what Melchizedek translates to, King of Righteousness. Also, he's the King of Salem. Salem, it was what is later becomes Jerusalem, and it literally means peace. So the word means peace. And so he's not only the King of Righteousness, he's the King of Peace. Does that sound familiar? Does that describe anybody that we might have heard of recently? You see how he's drawing this line. It's almost like God had anticipated this problem 2,000 years in advance and had this thing come up and recorded. And then he thought, well, maybe 1,000 years from now I'll have David write a psalm about it to make sure we're clear on it. That way, 2,000 years from this point, people will understand what's going on. Isn't that amazing? I think that's fascinating. He's without father or mother, without genealogy, having neither beginning of days nor end of days. He's not saying that Melchizedek was eternal. What he's saying is he was introduced, and anytime somebody important who was introduced in the Old Testament, they introduce him by saying he's so-and-so, the son of so-and-so, the son of so-and-so. They give a little genealogy to make sure that you know who he is. For example, I was reading this morning in Ezra. Take a look at Ezra 7 sometime when Ezra introduces himself. He introduces himself and he goes back 16 generations all the way back to the first high priest who was Aaron to make sure that you know who he is. That's his pedigree. That's his resume. Yep, I'm a Levite. That's what he's saying. Melchizedek is introduced He's not the son of anybody. We don't know who this guy is. He kind of bursts onto the scene. And he says, just like that, he's a priest. He doesn't have to be a Levite. So that's pretty amazing. I find that fascinating that God had planned that all along. For 2,000 years, he'd had this little nugget sitting in scriptures that they didn't really catch until now. So let's read on in Hebrews. Hebrews 7:11. Now, if perfection was through the Levitical priesthood, for on the basis of it the people received the law, what further need was there for another priest to arise according to the order of Melchizedek and not be designated according to the order of Aaron, who was a Levite? For when the priesthood is changed, of necessity there takes place a change of law also. Here is where we get to the real crucial part. Because right now we're like, who cares if Jesus is a priest? I'm not Jewish. This doesn't affect me. That was a long time ago. Well, here is why it affects you directly. What further need was there for another priest? What is he saying here? He's saying, look, if we could achieve righteousness through the old law, through the Levitical priesthood, why did God put this into place? Why are we even allowed to have a new order of priesthood in the order of Melchizedek? Why is that? Because God knew all along that it was temporary. That the Levitical priesthood and all that they did was all pointing forward to Christ. And Christ has now fulfilled all of it. And so things need to change. They're asking themselves, well, what do we do? Do we go to temple? And do we follow the rituals? And the author of Hebrews is saying, no. You don't have to. What further need was there to for another priest arise according to Melchizedek? Then he says, for when the priesthood is changed, the priesthood has changed hands. It's no longer Levitical priesthood. It's this order of Melchizedek. So when the priesthood is changed, of necessity, there takes place a change of the law also. This was probably pretty terrifying for them. They had been brought up their whole lives understanding that God had given them the law. And they needed to follow the law in order to relate to God. And it was so important to God that they do that, that when they failed to follow the law, they had to have sacrifices in order to pay for that sin. This is what most people think of religion today, right? Religion is about, a bunch of rules. The Bible is a rule book, and it's about a bunch of rules. And if you don't follow those rules, God's going to get mad, and he's going to hit you with the smiting. And you're going to be smote, and then you're not going to be very happy anymore, right? But when you do follow the rules, God's pretty happy, and he stays out of your business, right? That's how most people think of religion. I'm here to argue today that the Bible is clearly not a rule book, because here he is saying the law has changed. In fact, he goes on to say, this is in Romans 3:20, by the works of the law, no flesh will be justified in his sight. For through the law becomes the knowledge of sin. What's he saying here? The law was important, and it still is. It gives us a glimpse into the moral character of God, our Creator. But nobody ever was saved through following the law. Not then, and not now. Everybody who died before Christ was only saved because they looked forward to the promise of Christ to come. Everybody who's going to be saved after Christ is only saved because they look at Christ and the work that he's done in the past. Christ is the linchpin of the Bible. And he's saying here that the law is important, but it's not important to save you. In other words, you can't be good enough to get to God. And you never could. Nobody ever could. The purpose of the law was to bring knowledge of sin. Was to bring a knowledge of sin. And Galatians, Paul says that the law has become our tutor, and it teaches us our need for forgiveness. In other words, what the law has done is, up until then, people just kind of did what they thought they should. And it was anarchy. Nobody who does evil thinks of themselves as, I'm an evil person. Most people think that what they're doing is justified. Anytime we sin, anytime we do something that we know is wrong, we usually justify it in our minds because we know it's wrong. And what the law is something that shows us, you know what, I am broken. What I have done is wrong. That's the point of it. It's not to relate to God. Well, if I follow it, God will be happy. Well, that's true, but nobody can. So the law points out that we're broken. It points out that we're sinful, and it allows us to turn to God, and is there another way? I can't work my way to you. Is there another way? And God happily says yes. Unfortunately, he's just, and the penalty for sin is death. That can't change. Otherwise, he wouldn't be perfect. But he decided to go ahead and allow a substitute to take our place, and that's what Christ was all about. We talked a lot about that last week, that we can rest assured now that we're saved when we come to God and we say, I want Christ's death to pay for my sins because I can't do it. The law has to change. I can't work my way to you anymore, God. I never could. And I'm going to stop trying. I want Christ's death to pay for my sin. That's what the law was for, to convict us that we're wrong. And so the law has changed. And so these Jewish believers no longer had to follow these rituals because all they did was that they were for was to point them towards the need for a Savior who has already come now. And they no longer need to follow these rituals. We read on in Hebrews. The one concerning whom these things are spoken belongs to another tribe from which no one has officiated at the altar. Yeah, he's saying, yep, we're talking about Jesus, and he's from the tribe of Judah, and no one from Judah has ever been a priest. In fact, they were pretty strict about that. If somebody did try to do that, they were in big trouble. For it is evident that our Lord was descended from Judah, a tribe with reference to which Moses spoke nothing concerning priests. And this is clearer still, though. If another priest arises according to the likeness of Melchizedek, who has become such not on the basis of law of physical requirement, but according to the power of an indestructible life, for it is attested of him that you are a priest forever according to the order of Melchizedek. So he's saying the only way that another priest could come along is if he's according to the order of Melchizedek, and you can't just do that by being born in the order of Melchizedek, like you're born a Levite, because we don't even know where Melchizedek was from, right? We don't know his genealogy. That's not the point. The point is you have to be assigned. And Christ was assigned forever according to the order of Melchizedek. So there we have his argument. It's pretty airtight that Christ, not only is he our king, he's also our priest, which means he's our high priest, which means he's our intermediary between us and God. We have a problem with God, and it's our sin, and he is now taking care of that. He's our intermediary. And so what we're going to read for the rest of our passage here in Hebrews 7 is I think there are three pretty big implications that come along with that. Here's the first one. We can be close to God. He says, on the one hand, there is a setting aside of the former commandment because its weakness and uselessness. He's talking about the law. That's pretty bold language, calling the law useless. But it was useless for saving people. For the law made nothing perfect, he said. But on the other hand, there is a bringing in of a better hope through which we can draw near to God. You see, you don't have to work your way to God. You never could. You can't do it. We need to lay that aside because when you lay that aside, that's when you get this better hope. There's a better hope. If you're trying to work your way to God, trying to be good enough for him, your hope is pretty slim, if you're like me. Because every time you screw up, you're going to think, oh, I blew it. And you're going to beat yourself up. But we have a better hope. When we lay aside the whole idea of trying to earn our way to God, then through Christ, we can have this better hope. And this better hope is laid out really well in Romans 6, 1 and 2. He says, what should we say? Are we to continue to sin so that grace may increase? May it never be. Shall we who died to sin still live in it? What's he saying here? Well, he says our behavior does matter. That was the big concern. When you lay aside the law, does that mean that people can just do whatever they want and still get into heaven? Well, the answer is yes and no. Yes, God forgives all of our sin through Christ. But no, that's not how we're supposed to live. And one of the arguments that people were making to Paul was, well, I guess if grace is so good, we should sin even more so we can get more grace. And he's arguing against that here in Romans 6. He says, of course that's not the case. May it never be. Christ did not die so that we could sin more. He didn't die so that we could go and be rebellious even more. He died to bring us in to his family so that we could draw near to God. But the idea of drawing near to God should look familiar. It was the first verse we looked at today. This is the whole point of his argument, starting in Hebrews 4. Let us draw near with confidence the throne of grace so that we may receive mercy and find grace to help in time of need. In other words, we can have a relationship with God. He's not just our king. He's not just our ruler. He's our Father. And now we can draw close to him because that thing that's been between us, our rebellious nature, our sin, that's been taken care of. He took that and he put it aside and paid for that. Now there's nothing between you and God. We can draw near to him. We can be close to him. We can have a real relationship with him. We no longer need any other intermediary. Jesus is our high priest and he's the only one we'll ever need. That's amazing. We can achieve a level of closeness with God that we could never achieve by trying to work our way to him. Implication number two, we have an advocate. The former priests, on the one hand, existed in greater numbers because they were prevented from death, prevented by death from continuing it. Then that's pretty obvious, right? There are more of the old priests because they would die. They could only be priests as long as they were alive, and even then up until they were 60, and then they had to step down. But Jesus, on the other hand, because he continues forever, holds his priesthood permanently. Therefore, he is also able to save forever those who draw near to God through him, since he always lives to make intercession for them. This is the point here. He is always able to save us because he's always with God. He's always entered to intercede for us. It reminded me of 1 John chapter 2, verse 1, where he says that, my little children, I am writing these things to you that so you may not sin. And if, maybe better translated, when anyone sins, he'd rather you didn't, obviously, but when you do, we have an advocate with the Father, Jesus Christ the righteous. Now, I used to hear this passage, and I would think of this weird dynamic where God is up in heaven, and he's got his lightning bolt, and he's waiting for me, right? He's waiting for me to sin so he can just throw that lightning bolt at me and smite me. Like, God's always angry with me. And every time I'd sin, Jesus would step in and say, hang on, just chill out, God. It's okay. I know he did it again, but let's try to forgive him this time. And that's how I look at this. Jesus was okay. He was pretty chill, and God was angry. And he was always mad because I was always sinning. And that's the dynamic I had, and that's what I thought of when I looked at this passage, because we have an advocate. In other words, we have somebody arguing with God not to smite us all the time. But that's not what we have here. An advocate is someone who represents. Jesus represents us before God. And so when we sin, God, rightfully so, says that needs to be punished. God of justice needs to punish that. But he looks at Christ, our advocate, our representative, and he says, yep, that's been paid in full. In other words, God's not going to punish me for my sin because he's already punished Christ. If God is anything, he's just. He's not going to punish the same sin twice. Christ paid for it already. And he can look at Christ, and he can look at me through Christ, and he can smile, and he can say, he is my son. I can draw near to him, right? Because of what Christ has done. He's already paid for all of my sin. How great is that? Well, it doesn't make any sense, does it, to go back to the way of trying to work our way to God through obeying the law? That's the whole argument that the author here is making. He says, all that ritual you did, to continue that now is ridiculous. In fact, it's an insult. You're saying that what Christ did isn't enough. We have an advocate now. Why on earth would you go back to that? When I was a kid, my brother, he was a few years older than me. He was about 8 years older than me. And so when he got his driver's license, he was nice enough to let me sit on his lap and steer while he worked the pedals, which was very safe, right? I was about 8, and of course he had all the experience in the world. He was 16, and he would let me steer the car while he was driving. Look, I mean, we were safe. We didn't have any seatbelts, so we were good. But, so have you ever done that? Have you ever, when you were a kid, did you ever sit behind the wheel of a real car and pretend, I'm driving, right? How often do you do that once you get your driver's license? What's the point? I got the real thing. I don't need to pretend. I can really do it. That's what he's saying here. Why would you pretend that you can follow the Lord and relate to him through law when you know you can't, when now you've got the real thing, you've got the salvation that he's offering you? Why would you continue to pretend and insult him that way? Why would you insult God by saying, what you've done for me through Christ, that's nice, but it's not enough. I really think I need to go back to trying to obey your law and through doing your ritual. Why would you continue to do that? It makes no sense. We have an advocate all the time before Christ, or before God, through Christ. It makes no sense to go back. Implication number 3, worship has changed. It's different now. We think of worship as something that you do once a week in church. And that's not what worship is. Let's read on. He says, it was fitting for us to have such a high priest, holy and innocent, undefiled, separated from sinners, and exalted above the heavens, who does not need daily, like those other priests, to offer up sacrifices, first for his own sin and then for the sins of the people, because he did once for all when he offered up himself. For the law appoints men as high priests who are weak, but the word of the oath, which came from the law, appointed the Son, made perfect forever. What's he saying here? What's the point? We got a better priest now. You don't relate to God the same way through all the ritual. You don't worship him that way anymore. Why? Because he died once for all sin. Once he died for all of it. How much of your sin was in the future when Christ died? All of mine was. I'm not that old. It doesn't say that he died for all of your sin up until the point where you accept him, and then you got to live the straight and narrow. No, he died for all of it. All at one time, he died for all sin. Yours, mine, everybody's. He died for all sin. Our worship of him does not look the same anymore. That's his argument to the Hebrews. We have a new way to worship God. In Romans 12, 1 and 2, some of my favorite verses right here. He says, I urge you, brethren, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies as a living and holy sacrifice acceptable to God, which is your spiritual service of worship. This is what worship is looking like now. You want to offer a sacrifice to God? Don't bring him an animal. Offer your life. He doesn't want death. He wants you to live for him. You want to honor God? Live your life in a way that honors him. That's what he's saying here. How can we do that? How could these Hebrews do that? How could they have lived their whole lives associating to God in a specific way, very specific way, and now that's changed? How do they change the way they behave? How do we change the way we behave? Well, he goes on, do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, so that you may prove what the will of God is, that which is good and acceptable and perfect. You got to change the way you think about relating to God. You want to offer up a sacrifice to God that's acceptable? Live for him. You want to be able to do that? You're going to have to change the way you think that he wants you to relate to him. He does not want you to relate through your works. He wants you to relate to him as a father, out of love, out of humility, out of gratitude. That's how we change. That's how our behavior changes. Worship is different now. And I'm going to make one more point here about priests. Because while Jesus is now our high priest, most of us think that we still have this whole idea, it's called clergy versus laity, right? We have the clergy, those are the guys that wear the robes, and those are the ones who work at the church. Maybe they live there, I don't know. But those are the churchy people, and then you've got the laity, which is everybody else. And the clergy does all the work, right? And the laity, they just live their lives and they go to church every now and then and visit the clergy. That's not what we're looking at here. Peter says this, and this is a very fascinating passage that Peter has to say. He says, you, and he's talking about all Christians. You are a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people for God's own possession, so that you may proclaim the excellencies of him who has called you out of darkness into his marvelous light. Then he skips down to verse 12. He says, keep your behavior excellent among the Gentiles, the non-believers, so that in the thing in which they slander you as evildoers, they may, because of your good deeds, as they observe them, glorify God in the day of visitation. What's he saying here? You're a priest if you're a Christian. You're not the high priest, but you're a priest. What's the role of the priest? You may think, well, I can't be. I could never be a priest. I'm not holy enough. I'm not nice enough. I sin too much. Yeah, me too. I sin way too much. I'm not perfect, but that's not what we're called to do here, is it? He's saying you're a priest, therefore behave in such a way that non-believers look to you and say, I want to be like that. He's got something that I don't have. Not that he's perfect, but he's able to admit when he makes mistakes. That's what it means. That's what it means to be a living and holy sacrifice. And remember this when we're doing that, when we're called to be priests, because we have this idea of in our culture that priests are either judgmental or they're useless, right? But I want to remind you of what the role of the priest was. Remember back in verse 5, 2, he says he, when he was talking about the priest, he can deal gently with the ignorant and the misguided, since he himself also is beset with weaknesses. When we are representing God, it's not so that we can call out everybody else's sin. It's not so that we can judge everyone else and be angry. We should be dealing gently with people who don't believe what we believe. We should be dealing gently with them. We should be living in such a way that it proves our point that God wants us to live in such that way, right? If you're living in a way that God says is wrong, well, instead of me telling you that, let me demonstrate what it's supposed to look like. You see how it's different? We get this idea that we're supposed to, for some reason, Christians should be yelling at people. But that's not what this is for. We're supposed to be dealing gently with people who disagree with us, because we are filled with weakness. Part of being a Christian is admitting that we're sinners. We like to keep this idea that our sin is, yeah, I'm a sinner, but without naming anything specific, because that would be painful. But what they're doing over there is way worse. And that's not the case. All sin keeps us from God. It's only through Christ that we can be saved. So we shouldn't really be saying, well, your sin's worse than mine, so I'm going to yell at you, and not because that makes me feel better. We should be feeling better because God, through Christ, says we are better. He's healed us. And the only reason I'm better is because Christ has made me so. Wouldn't you like to be that way too? Wouldn't you like to allow God to work on your heart too? That's the point. Okay, so we're going to stop there. Hopefully you're all happy about this order of Melchizedek thing. We got prayer today. We do this once a month, first Sunday of the month. It's back in the hallway. I encourage you to come out. Even if you don't want to pray out loud, that's fine. Just being around other people who are is edifying. If you're a guest here, that's awesome. We've got free books for you. If you think good people go to heaven and you can work your way to God, well, then read this book, How Good is Good Enough. It lays out really well God's grading scale. If you're going to be good, good people get into heaven, you should know how good you have to be. The other one is Discovering God. If you've ever wondered, is there real solid evidence for believing in God, or is this a blind faith kind of thing? This Discovering God lays out some really solid, hard evidence for belief in God. All right, so we are going to have a time for questions and comments. If you have if you don't get to your question or if you don't want to ask in front of people, that's fine. You can fill out this card. You can drop it in the bag when it goes around, or if you have suggestions for us. That bag is also for us to financially support the church. This is not your church. We don't want your money. We're not asking you for your money. Feel free to pass the bag on by. So the kids are in Oasis until 11:45. So if you have a question or a comment, we're going to chat until then, but make sure you get your kids by 11:45. So, questions or comments, raise your hand. We'll bring you a microphone so we can all hear. Right up front here.
I'm not surfing the internet on my phone. I've got the Bible on my
phone.
Fair
enough. I wasn't judging.
That passage in 1 Peter where he says you're a chosen people, a royal priesthood. And then he says that you may declare the praises of him who brought you out of darkness. That's the NIV. The NASB says that you may proclaim the excellencies of who's in. How are we going to do that? We're going to do that verse.